Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Tulane University history professor Emily Clark, whose new book is The Strange History of the American Quadroon, Free Women of Color in the Revolutionary Atlantic World, and novelist Bill Lofelm, whose new thriller is The Devil in Her Way. Emily Clark is the Clement Chambers Benenson Professor of American Colonial History at Tulane University, which is a bang-up way of saying she knows and loves her field. She's the author of a study of the New Orleans Ursuline Nuns, Masterless Mistresses, the New Orleans Ursulines, and the Development of a New World Society, 1727 to 1834. She's here today to talk with us about her new book, The Strange History of the American Quadroon, Free Women of Color in the Revolutionary Atlantic World. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great. Now, it's quite a hop from the Ursulines to the Quadroons. So what spurred your interest in this new project?
Well, it's not a hop when you're in the archives. So while I was writing the book on the Ursulines, one of the things I noticed was the large number of free women of color getting married. And they were sprinkled in there with all the other things that I was looking at in the sacramental records for the Ursuline nuns. So I sort of filed that information away, and it lurked in my historical imagination for a long time, and just every now and then would sort of bug me, and I'd think, I need to go back to that because it just doesn't fit with a few other things. So it seems like a leap. But actually, when you're in the archives, everything is close together and connected.
That reminds me of Carolyn Morrow Long saying she'd been doing research on Marie Laveau and then moved to Madame Lalaurie because they were next to each other in the archives.
It's so true. It's so true.
Oh, now, so much of what you see as your work as an historian involves correcting perceived notions, you know, setting the record straight. So tell us, you know, what's behind the record you're setting here.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of things. One is that we historians like for things to fit. We like for what's in the archives to fit with what we think we know about the past. And more often than not, things don't fit with what we think we know about the past. So most books start with a mystery to solve. And I've said before, historians love mysteries. And so the mystery for me was, why are there all these records of free women of color getting married in the wonderful sacramental registers of New Orleans? But at the same time, we have this huge mythology about free women of color in New Orleans as women who never got married and who instead preferred to take up with white men who kept them in little houses and never married them and broke their hearts. And so these women were consigned to a very particular kind of life. And there are loads of books and articles, and people are still writing books and articles with this mythology in mind. And so I wanted to figure out why we had this disconnect. So a lot of what I do is grounded in archives and then comes about because it's not so much about setting the record straight, is making things fit with what the archives have to tell us, going back to the basics.
And marriage is such an important social indicator in this book.
It is. It's a really important social indicator. It's very much in the news today. The whole business of what marriage is, what it means, what the state's interest in it is. And one of the things that began to bother me more and more about the disconnect between the myth and the reality that I was finding in the archives was that free women of color were denied the great marker of respectability for women in the 19th century. Respectability was defined by being married, by being a pious wife and mother. And black women were just excluded from that notion. And so respectable womanhood, being a lady, was something that was denied to Black women in the 19th century. And so here was this group of women in New Orleans who were proving that presumption wrong at every turn, and they've been forgotten. So part of what I wanted to do was to restore that population to the city's history.
And one of the interesting things for me after talking to Rebecca Scott about the Freedom Papers is just how fragile that paper trail can be in some ways, but yet at the same time, so enduring. You know, that's what proves your point in this. So I'm curious to know how many of these women that you were studying were actually literate, could read and write?
Ah, quite a few of them. Many of them signed their names on the marriage record that's in the sacramental register. Many of them also signed their marriage contracts. We can find those in the notarial archives here in New Orleans. And my guess is that many of them in the 18th century were educated at the Ursuline Convent. And there are some student records from that period that show that there were free girls of color enrolled at the school.
Wow.
So literacy was not something that was denied to these women. Some of them were very successful businesswomen who kept their own books and negotiated their own deals. So many of them were undoubtedly literate.
Now, in addition to your work in the archives, which I imagine was time-consuming and eye-wearing a bit, you went on to examine how the stereotypes endured in literature and even in film. So I wish you'd talk about that reading a little bit, because I could see you reading these books and getting furiouser and furiouser by the minute.
I was getting furiouser and furiouser, especially the further away from reality it got. You know, most of the accounts of New Orleans free women of color that were journalistic, that is, that came from newspapers or came from travelers' accounts, were written by men. And so the first thing that made me furious was that it was a bunch of guys coming down to New Orleans, and they saw what they were looking for more often than not. And the other thing was that they kept plagiarizing one another. They would just rip each other off without attribution, willy-nilly. And so the same descriptions just kept getting recycled over and over again. So it made me very sensitive to how when we go to a place that's foreign to us, we are conditioned by what people who have been there before say about it. And so what we see is often what we are looking for. And the place that is being visited often produces what people are looking for. So that was one of the things that bothered me. But even worse were all the really bad novels that were written about New Orleans quadroons. And they were truly awful and made even more horrible by the fact that they go on for hundreds and hundreds of pages. And so they portray New Orleans free women of color as basically inhabitants of some kind of a harem or seraglio who wore jewels, you know, in every way they possibly could and dripped silk and lived in rooms that were full of carpets and ottomans and painted tiles. You could have just stepped right into a Moroccan harem. And so one of the things about those novels is that they really portrayed New Orleans from the 1840s as a place that was really foreign and exotic. And, you know, you don't have to go to Morocco to have this kind of an experience. You can just go to New Orleans.
And yet the women on the book jacket illustration are very demure ladies out for a walk.
They are. They are. Yeah.
So one of the duties of the historian, I think, is to make history come alive and to involve the reader in the time, which you do so beautifully. But what really makes history come alive for people is finding that human point of connection. So what is it that drew you to these women as different from you as can be over such a long time span? What is your point of connection with them?
Oh, what a good question. They were misread and misunderstood. And what woman in contemporary America doesn't feel misread and misunderstood? I think historians, especially female historians, feel a duty to allow these women to be seen as they wished themselves to be seen. And so that was one of the things that drew me to them, I think. And also the fact that their story has been so important to construing New Orleans as a place where people come to be naughty. And I knew that wasn't the case from my encounters with them in the archive. I knew that they weren't naughty. And so I wanted to bring their true selves, as they imagine themselves to be, to light. I guess that's what I'm always drawn to, people whose stories aren't told, whose voices aren't heard, I guess.
I know. We think of these women and we think of them as silent, I guess.
Yes. Yes.
So, well, and now we know their names, thanks to you.
Thank you.
It's an amazing, amazing book. So what's next for you? Do you know what's drawing you into the archives now?
I do. It actually comes out of this project. You know, all things are connected for historians, even if they don't seem to be. And one of the characters in this book, listen to me, I'm calling him a character. One of the people who emerges from these pages is a free man of color named Noel Carrière, who was...
Oh, I loved him because he was always showing up as
yes,
a witness
yes,
at the wedding ceremonies.
That's right.
Oh.
That's
oh,
right. In his uniform, with his medals from the American Revolution. He was born a slave, but rose to become the captain of the Free Black Militia. And through our wonderful archives here, I can trace his entire life history pretty much. And that's a pretty rare thing. It's very, very hard to reconstruct the entire life of a person who was born enslaved in colonial Louisiana and who died just after the Louisiana Purchase in 1804. So I think of this biography as a gift that I want to give to the city. We have biographies of Bienville and Galvez, and we have my book on the Ursuline nuns. But I really want to give the city the story of this man's life.
Oh, he's so intriguing.
He is.
Colonial history is where it's happening now, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You can meet Emily Clark, who is the author of The Strange History of the American Quadroon, Free Women of Color in the Revolutionary Atlantic World, Tuesday, April 30th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much, Emily.
Thank you, Susan.
Bill Lofelm is, luckily for readers, well-launched in his career as a thriller writer. His first book, Fresh Kills, was set in his native Staten Island, as were his second and third, Bloodroot and The Devil She Knows. His fourth novel, The Devil in Her Way, brings Maureen Coughlin to New Orleans, where she is on probation as a new member of the post-Katrina New Orleans Police Department. And let me tell you, it's a zinger. You won't want to put it down. Welcome to The Reading Life, Bill.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
Welcome back, rather. Now, I love having Maureen in New Orleans. I love it.
Thank you, so do I.
Do you plan to stick with this for a while?
Yes. This is going to be the series, Her, here in New Orleans.
Oh, great. So what was it like for you to come here at last, come home and be writing about New Orleans?
You know, it was funny. I just had I was writing an essay for a blog for the launch of the book, and I just had the realization that the first book I wrote in New Orleans, I tried to set it in Louisiana. It was right after I got here, and it didn't work at all. And I reset it on Staten Island. This is Fresh Kills, and it took off. And this book didn't go anywhere till I set it in New Orleans and took it out of New York. So it's exciting. It's intimidating to write about this place. And it was fun to go back and be new again. I've been here going on 16 years, and to think about what it was like to be here the first 6 months, the first year, to go through the first summer, to, you know, watch. I live in the Garden District. Maureen lives in the Garden District. To watch it bloom in the spring and to revisit all those things for the first time was a lot of fun.
Nobody ever forgets the first summer. I mean,
yeah, I moved here in August, too. And I had
Me
absolutely,
too.
I mean, I was a teacher at the time, so I had to come for the start of the school year, but there's no preparing for it.
Now, set us up a bit with the predicament Maureen finds herself in here.
Oh, well, Maureen is new in all kinds of ways. She's new to New Orleans. She's new as a police officer. She doesn't know anybody on the job in the city. She's really on her own. For the first time, one of the things about her old life was its familiarity. And so the challenge of her new life is all these different identities as a new person, as a new police officer, as a woman on a police force, as an outsider in New Orleans and on the police force. There's all these different roles that she has to play and all these different languages that she has to figure out how to speak to the people in her the neighborhood in the 6th District where she works, to her fellow cops, to her authority figures that she's answerable to. So it's really a challenge for her. And as far as the plot is concerned, she's tangentially involved in a murder. Someone she had spoken to about a crime earlier in the day turns up dead that night. And so the detective investigating the murder involves her and basically gives her homework, which is to find 3 neighborhood boys who may or may not have been witnesses to the crime and may or may not be in danger. So most of the book is Maureen's pursuit of these boys and her efforts to protect them as the threat to them gets worse and worse.
And we all know that young boys lead hard, hard lives in New Orleans now, as then. So when you were writing this book, this seems to me to be a more direct change to a police procedural. How did you educate yourself in those kinds of details about the cops here?
I have friends who were on the job, and I had dinner with them a couple of times and asked questions. Mm-hmm. And I listened to the police scanner a little bit to hear some of the lingo, and I talked to friends who are cops in New York, and you see which things are seem to be universal from city to city. But mostly just talking to people who work on the police force.
Listening to that police scanner's an eye-opener, though, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah.
Woo! So I wonder if you'd read just a little bit from The Devil in Her Way for us.
Absolutely. Everyone returned from the storm to something different from what they had left, Maureen had learned. Not a lot of people, not most people, everyone. Even if it was just a part-time job or the way the light came through the trees in the evening, everyone had seen something change for good. Over the course of a morning, an entire city of people had lost their present lives. The sense of immediate loss she could relate to, the idea that one day your life is this way, and the next it's not. The head you lift off the pillow isn't the same one you laid there the night before. She'd been through this kind of thing when she was a kid and her father left for good. While standing on the roof of her mother's house, watching the smoke billow from the Twin Towers, in her personal nightmare with Sebastian from a little over a year ago. The scale of what had happened in New Orleans, though, a loss like that hitting a whole city at once, a city bleeding out like a murder victim with her throat cut, going empty of people first in a flood and then in a trickle, was a hard thing for Maureen to get her mind around. Even those times her life had changed overnight, she'd at least awoken in the same bed in the same city the next morning with her people, few in number as they may have been, surrounding her. By now, a lot of the people helping to refill and revive New Orleans were transplants like Maureen, who hadn't had a life to lose here before the storm. She knew that some of her fellow reinforcements, maybe most, had lost their lives wherever they were from. Like her, they had arrived here in search of something new, in their own way washed ashore in New Orleans by the flood.
It just gets me still. To read passages like that. That's
Thank
amazing.
You.
Now, one of the things that Maureen says near the end of the book is that she feels that New Orleans is a city with lessons to teach her. So what are some of the lessons that New Orleans has taught you in your time here?
Slow down. There are different ways to work hard. There are different rewards for hard work other than money, such as time, such as I was just having lunch with a friend of mine, Jared Lofsted from Nola Fuji's. And yesterday afternoon, we were at Mahoney's and we were just talking about life and trying to make art and make money and make a living in New Orleans. And he said, you know, we are having lunch outside on the patio at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday. So we must be doing something right. And city's taught me a lot about priorities.
Absolutely.
People and time are really more important than money or things.
Well, a lot of that shines through this book.
Thank you.
As you'd expect. Now, you have a mantra in this book for Preacher, and mm-hmm. It's also a mantra for Maureen eventually, and it's believe. How did that come to you? What is that personal meaning for you?
That's where his nickname comes from, is that he, when he says something important, that's like his emphasis is believe mm-hmm. it, believe that. From the saints, from living here and trying to have faith that things are going to get better. It's an old, and I grew up a Mets fan, too, and it was a big, from, you know, their 1969 World Series run that was, believe, was mm-hmm. just one of the logos. So it's kind of a word that's always been around, and it just, it was something that Maureen could kind of take as her own.
And she does. And she does. I love that. It's just because I do think that living here is an act of belief and faith.
Well, starting over is an act of faith.
Absolutely.
You know, that's something that she does. And she, I think she thinks of herself as a very cynical, jaded person, but there's a real heart in there that wants to believe and wants to have faith. And I think one of the fun things about writing her is writing someone who knows where they want to be and knows what they want to be and is fighting to get there and to keep it. As opposed, you know, the first three of my books, even the first one involving her, were about people who are kind of lost and have kind of lost their way. And this book is very much about someone who's found where they want to be and is fighting to make it.
Well, I hope a lot of readers turn out to welcome her to New Orleans.
Thank you.
I really do. You can meet Bill Lofum when he signs The Devil in Her Way, Tuesday, April 30th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop, and again at Jazz Fest in the Book Tent May 3rd from 3 to 4. But don't start reading unless you can stay up all night with it. It's that good. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you for having me back, Susan.
Back for a return engagement today is visiting poet Dennis Formento, a New Orleans native who's been a part of our literary scene for a long time indeed. Dennis has recorded some of the poems from his new book, Looking for an Out Place, and he's going to read for us again from that book today. Some of these poems are wedding poems. Dennis, talk about that event in your life as an inspiration.
Yeah, all hail Patricia Hart. These were supposed to be sonnets, actually, and a couple of them actually are, but I kind of got tired of fooling with the sonnet form, and I just said they were poems, just plain poems. But my dear wife is somebody that I actually had known for many years, and, many years before, and we kind of lost track of each other and crossed paths in a certain club on Frenchman Street, and then the rest took care of itself. But we got married about 6 years ago now, and wedding poems. Why marry when love is real and here to stay, guaranteed to last? When other couples love on, years go by and they're together to this day, will we be happy this way? Whether we're apart and brief reminders of our love's kickstart, it's 5 nights sleep long absences, it's months out of town in Mexico and Rocky Mountains. So why marry? So I don't, in some room, reproach myself for what I had but ill-deserved, someone I loved but kicked, or by whom was kicked to the curb. The quick mind learns more than logic designs, that love has just one heart but 2 eyes. The next beloved, no, I am not stone, but now I'll train my mind on one alone. After William Shakespeare's Sonnet 115. Lines I wrote before are full of lies. Even when I've said I couldn't love you more, and even so I couldn't figure why my brightest light would not glow in spite of passing time, whose fractal increments break promises and treaties, contracts, kings and queens, wear beauty out, blunt sharp instruments, sweep big ideas down the sidewalk to the street. Why shouldn't I, aware of wasting time, say for real, I love you the best, since I am sure beyond uncertainties. Living only now, forsaking all the rest, this love's a babe. Should I not say so? Most funnest one of all, let's let it grow.
I love those, Dennis. We've been listening to Dennis Formento read from his book, Looking for an Out Place. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tuesday, April 23rd, is World Book Night. Hope to see you out on the streets either giving or receiving books. A special group of givers will be handing out books in bars, places like Finn McCool's, Cajun's Pub, Siberia, the Hi-Ho Lounge, and the Lost Love Lounge. Poet Alana Bell reads from Eyes, Stones, the winner of the 2011 Walt Whitman Award from the Academy of American Poets, Wednesday, April 24th at 8 p.m. in the UNO Fine Arts Gallery. Jen Sincero signs You Are a Badass, How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life, Wednesday, April 24th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Sarah Carr discusses Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children, Wednesday, April 24th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Will Tustin signs Ambushed, Thursday, April 25th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Bill Zavatsky and Michael Todd Edgerton read their work Thursday, April 25th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. That's part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. There will be a Jazz Fest open mic reading Sunday, April 28th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Sunday Shorts Reading Series begins Sunday, April 30th at 8 at the Red Star Gallery at 2513 Bayou Road. First readers in the series are El Kasimu Harris and Sabrina Canfield. The Pirates Alley Faulkner Society presents 5 New Orleans authors at a reception Tuesday, April 30th at 5:30 at the Cabildo. Deborah Shriver signs The Spirit of New Orleans, Brenda Marie Osby, History and Other Poems, Judy Connor, Southern Fried Divorce, The After Party, Sandim Ozdural signs Liga, and N.S. Patrick signs The Mysteries of Jack the Ripper. The event is free, but please RSVP to falkhouse@aol.com. Today's guest, Bill Lofelm, signs The Devil in Her Way, Tuesday, April 30th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. And today's guest, Emily Clark, signs A Strange History of the American Quadroon, Free Women of Color in the Revolutionary Atlantic World, Tuesday, April 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. And don't forget, as you wander the fairgrounds this first weekend at Jazz Fest, visit the book tent sponsored by New Orleans Gulf South Booksellers. Proceeds benefit local children's literacy projects. Here's who's on deck to sign books. Friday, April 26th, Phil Sandusky signs New Orleans, Impressionist Cityscapes, noon to 1. Elsa Hahn signs The Gravy from 2 to 3. And Denise McConduit signs her DJ books from 3 to 4. Saturday, April 27th, Sally Newhart signs Original Tuxedo Jazz Band from noon to 1. Tom Piazza signs The Southern Journey of Alan Lomax from 1 to 2. David Spielman signs When Not Performing from 2 to 3. Poppy Tooker signs Madame Begay's Recipes of Old New Orleans Creole Cookery from 3 to 4. Christy Rice and Megan Nolan sign When the Lights Went Out in the City from 4 to 5, and Edward Branley signs Legendary Locals of New Orleans from 5 to 6. Sunday, April 28th, Allison Vines Rushing and Slade Rushing sign Southern Comfort Cookbook from noon to 1, Deb Shriver signs In the Spirit of New Orleans from 1 to 2, Johnette Downing signs her children's book How to Dress a Po' Boy from 2 to 3, John McCusker signs his biography of Kid Ory from 3 to 4, and the Neighborhood Story Project signs Straight Out of Swampton from 5 to 6. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.